Right-wing Dutch politician who's called for the Quran to be banned is to be sent home from London within the hour.
It's a very sad day. It proves that your government, your Prime Minister Brown, is really the biggest coward in Europe and not allowing free speech from a parliamentarian from another country.
Jailing the parents of truants. Does it work?
It absolutely terrified me that my mum was going to prison, and I felt really awful. And when that happened, I just thought, I need to turn my life around. I need to get back into school and prove that I can do this.
The Queen relaunches her website.
If we go back to the 16th century, the monarchy is at the cutting edge of a much bigger media revolution than the web. It's called printing.
And why scientists say this is all wrong. Sorry, follow that, Carolyn. The BBC News is read this evening by Carolyn Brown.
A right-wing Dutch politician who was banned from the United Kingdom is to be flown home shortly after arriving at Heathrow Airport. Geert Wilders travelled to Britain despite being told by the Home Office that he would be denied entry because his opinions were a threat to public security. He'd been due to attend a screening of a film he's made criticising Islam. Mr. Wilders said Gordon Brown had shown himself to be the biggest coward in Europe. Lord Pearson of the UK Independence Party, who invited Mr. Wilders to London, said the government had been wrong to ban him.
He's certainly a very brave man, and he's a very genuine man, and he's not trying to inflame or infuriate anyone. He's just trying to get Western society to wake up and stand up to the violent Islamists. I think it's an incredible mistake to ban him, because he could be there, and you could put these questions to him. But that's the decision of the glorious, appeasing British Home Office.
Gordon Brown has denied that he was warned about the problems at Halifax Bank of Scotland several years before the bank was rescued. The Prime Minister was giving evidence to a committee of senior MPs amid growing opposition criticism of his handling of the banking crisis. Here's Norman Smith.
The FSA first investigated concerns about risk management at HBOS back in 2002, prompting opposition claims that Mr. Brown, as the then Chancellor, must have been told there were worries about the bank. In the Commons, the Shadow Chancellor George Osborne claimed the net is closing in on the Prime Minister over the banking crisis. However, Mr. Brown, appearing before the Liaison Committee, insisted the FSA had never raised any concerns with the Treasury about HBOS, a bank which has now had to be propped up with £11 billion worth of taxpayers' money.
The Serious Fraud Office is investigating suspected illegal transactions in the British operations of the giant American insurance group AIG. The company was bailed out last year by the US authorities after suffering a liquidity crisis. The family of a retired army officer who shot himself on Tuesday has blamed the banking crisis for his death. Major Bill Foxton, who lived near Southampton, lost his life savings in hedge funds run by the American financier Bernard Madoff, who's accused of one of the biggest frauds in Wall Street's history. The number of parents in England and Wales being prosecuted for their child's truancy has almost doubled since 2000. Research by BBC News has found that more than 10,000 parents are being taken to court every year and between 20 and 30 jailed. Despite that, truancy rates have risen. The government says plans for a new fleet of trains to replace the Intercity 125s will create or safeguard 12,500 jobs. The contract to build the Super Express trains for the Great Western and East Coast mainlines has been awarded to a consortium made up of Hitachi, Barclays and John Lang. A factory for manufacturing the trains will be built in the UK as part of a £7.5 billion project. The Transport Secretary Geoff Hoon said the new expresses would be fitted with the latest technology.
They will be able to operate right across our railway network, providing shorter journey times, more passenger seats, and more environmentally friendly transport. We recognise that there are significant problems of overcrowding. This will allow more passengers on each coach. Those coaches themselves will be longer. So it's real good news all round for the rail network, but also for British jobs.
The Attorney General has asked the Court of Appeal to consider whether unduly lenient sentences were given to three men who raped a 16-year-old girl before dousing her with caustic soda to try to destroy evidence. The three were jailed for between 6 and 9 years for the attack in North London. Their victim was left permanently disfigured. Heavy snow has forced hundreds of schools to close in Scotland and northeast England. North Yorkshire County Council says some parts of the North York Moors had 6 inches of snow in 6 hours.
Thanks, Carolyn. 5 past 5. Turned back at Heathrow, but the fact that the Dutch MP Geert Wilders has been refused entry to Britain has done nothing to stem the controversy surrounding him. His anti-Islam film Fitness still got a showing at the House of Lords in the last hour. We'll be hearing reaction to it in a moment. Mr. Wilders himself only got as far as immigration at Heathrow before he was turned back. Our correspondent Jane Peel is at the airport. Jane.
Well, flight BD-104 from Amsterdam to London Heathrow touched down just after 2 o'clock this afternoon. Mr. Wilders was on it along with hordes of journalists. They accompanied him into the immigration hall. They, of course, came through to arrivals. Mr. Wilders never made it. He was approached by immigration officials who invited him off into an office for a discussion, and he was told he was going to be deported as a result of the letter that he'd received from the Home Secretary saying that he was not welcome in this country. So, of course, there were a number of people waiting for him, mainly journalists in the arrivals hall. They didn't get to see him. The Dutch ambassador himself was airside to accompany him. But we understand he is either on his way back to Amsterdam now or at least will be very shortly. Now, before that happened, Mr. Wilders did manage to speak to the BBC on his mobile phone as he waited to be deported. And in that interview, he accused the British government of being weak.
I saw that even in the Dutch, in the United Kingdom, in the English press, an editorial of the Times, people who disagree with what I say but agreed with the fact that I should be able to say it. I'm not convicted of any crime in any country in the world. It's a very sad day. It proves that your government, your Prime Minister Brown, is really the biggest coward in Europe and not allowing free speech from a parliamentarian from another country.
Well, Mr. Wilders, of course, had received a letter on Tuesday on behalf of the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, saying his presence in the UK would pose a genuine, present and sufficiently serious threat to one of the fundamental interests of society. And it was said that his beliefs, as expressed in that film Fitna and elsewhere, would threaten community harmony and therefore public security in the United Kingdom. But in that interview, he denied that he was a threat to the UK's security.
I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not protesting or marching through the streets of London. I'm just, as an elected parliamentarian, I'm representing today, if you look at the polls, the third biggest party of the Netherlands. Come on, I'm invited by a UK parliamentarian. What's wrong by going there and even talk to people who disagree with me? Let's talk to one another. Let's speak to one another. And if we have differences, democracy means differences and debate. And it's a very sad day if the United Kingdom today took, when it comes to the freedom of speech, really the country 2 centuries back by sending and banning an elected parliamentarian from the Netherlands.
Well, of course, the Dutch government had supported his visit here, and the Dutch foreign minister had spoken by telephone to the foreign secretary, David Miliband, to express his displeasure that a Dutch MP was being prevented from travelling to another EU country. Also spoke to the British ambassador in The Hague to press for that decision to be reconsidered. And, of course, that decision was taken by the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith. And today, Mr. Miliband defended her decision and the government's decision to bar Mr. Wilders.
The Home Secretary made a decision on an individual case, as she's required to do. He was invited to screen his programme, which includes extreme anti-Muslim hate. And we have very clear laws in this country. We have profound commitment to freedom of speech born over hundreds of years. But there is no freedom to cry fire in a crowded theatre. There is no freedom to stir up hate, religious and racial hatred, according to the laws of the land. And what the Home Secretary did was follow the laws of the land.
Well, of course, all this controversy has provided Mr. Wilders and that very controversial film with rather a lot of free publicity. Caroline.
Jane, thanks very much. We'll be discussing that with Lord Ahmed, who opposed his visit in a moment. But despite the absence of Mr. Wilders himself, the debate he wanted to provoke is taking place right now among a group of peers who viewed his 15-minute film Fitna, which intercuts verses of the Quran with footage of the Madrid and 9/11 attacks. It also shows the beheading of a Westerner in Iraq and Islamic preachers urging violence against non-Muslims. Our political correspondent Ian Watson is in the Lords. And Ian, what reaction, first of all, has there been to Mr. Wilders being banned from the UK?
Well, I went along to what was described as a private screening of this film in the House of Lords, and although this is an issue about free speech, as some people would see it, there's actually objections to myself and a couple of newspaper journalists being there. But the view of the majority at the meeting was that we should be allowed to stay, and the meeting began with a denunciation of an example of what was called an example of censorship by keeping Mr. Wilders out of Britain, not letting him through security at Heathrow. And in addition to that, there was also various contributions from the meeting saying that, in effect, there had to be a debate about Islam and about freedom of speech, and why was it that only Geert Wilders' freedom of speech was being reined in, when actually Islamic preachers, who some of the people at the meeting seem to think were preaching hate, were free to go about their everyday work.
Now, the film can be viewed on the internet. It was shown, as you say, in the House of Lords. Just give us a brief description of what you saw in the film.
Yes, as you were saying, it intercuts verses from the Quran, verses such as those who've disbelieved are signs shall roast in fire, and then intercuts this with, for example, 9/11 and the now rather iconic pictures of the Twin Towers collapsing. Also, perhaps the most gory scene, as you mentioned, was seeing someone being beheaded, and the film was viewed in complete silence until that moment. And at that moment, there's a sharp intake of breath, and various people were saying, "Oh my God!" when that happened. But at the end of the film, strangely enough, the audience actually gave this a bit of a round of applause. But I should say that it wasn't hugely widely attended. There was only about 30 people who actually watched this private screening of the film, and then there was a debate, obviously, about the film immediately afterwards.
Indeed, and their argument was it that they needed to have that debate?
The argument was that there ought to be that debate. I think what was perhaps more controversial about the film wasn't simply seeing these terrorist attacks, but whether the film itself was propaganda, because it then intercuts into the growing number of Muslims, for example, in the Netherlands, and there's a sequence about what the future might look like when people who are purported in the film to be gay are seen to be executed. So at the end of that, it was stressed that the vast majority of Muslims, as the people attending the meeting would see it, are obviously law-abiding, but nonetheless, the kind of message that was being preached by some of the people who are highlighted in the film ought to be talked about. So this went beyond simply the freedom of Geert Wilders to produce this film. There's also calls at that meeting for a debate about Islam and the sort of issues raised by that film, okay, even though the film was seen by many as propaganda.
Ian Watson, thank you. Well, a few minutes ago, I spoke to Lord Ahmed, the Muslim peer who's opposed the screening of Fitna. I put it to him that banning Geert Wilders from the country hadn't stopped the film from being shown in the House of Lords.
The film was on the internet anyway, and anybody could have watched it. I think this was a deliberate attempt to bring in a man who is indicted for causing religious hatred in his own country, but more importantly, a man who does not have any regards to law or authority. The Home Secretary has issued a letter to him, but he nevertheless still wanted to show his power, and he came to London, and hence he's been deported.
But Lord Ahmed, why did the UK allow him to visit Parliament just a few weeks ago?
Well, I don't know why the UK allowed him then, but probably...
Seems strange, doesn't it? What's happened in the last 2 weeks?
Well, probably because he was there in a private meeting, but here he was trying to hold a meeting for parliamentarians. He was provoking a reaction. He has been indicted for incitement to racial hatred in his own country. Since then, you know, since his last visit, the Court of Appeal in Amsterdam has indicted him, and he has to appear before a court with a very serious charge.
Well, you may find his views repugnant, and others may, but in a democracy, he does have a right to be heard. And wouldn't it have been a good idea to have this debate with him present?
Absolutely, and I also have a right to...
So you think he should have been present?
Well, what I'm saying is that I also have a right to have a religious belief without being threatened and abused, like his supporters at the British National Party that have been doing that for the last 2 weeks.
But you see, banning him seems to have invited even more publicity for his film. If he'd been allowed to come and have the discussion in Parliament, it may not have had as much attention as it has now.
It's very unfortunate that the UKIP members of the House of Lords deliberately wanted this cheap publicity. It's very unfortunate that he's got all this attention. Had he just been visiting private members in the House of Lords, I don't think there would have been any discussion whatsoever. But because he's doing this and deliberately taking the Quran out of context, and of course expecting a reaction, and the very reason, because there are hundreds of his supporters, or the supporters of the British National Party, have been sending hate mail, threats and abuse to myself, obviously I had to report this to the authorities and ask them not to allow him to come to the United Kingdom.
So are you saying then that if he would have been allowed in, then he would have incited hatred, that you would have been a victim of violence perhaps yourself?
Well, I certainly have been threatened with that. I certainly have received hundreds of emails and telephone calls in my office. My office staff have had threats from people from Europe as well as the UK. I've had emails right from California into Europe. So there's an evidence. I'm quite happy to provide it to anyone.
But isn't barring him going to make people feel even more angry towards those people who've stopped him from coming here?
But at least he's not given the opportunity of inciting people here in London. He can do it from his own country. But, you know, we've had a tradition in the past, those people who have been abusive, insulting, that could cause to, that could lead to a national security threat, we've always banned them.
Lord Ahmed, 17 minutes past five now. Carolyn has the PM headlines.
A right-wing Dutch politician who flew to Britain despite being banned by the Home Secretary has been detained at Heathrow. Geert Wilders was due to present a film that he's made about Islamic extremism and is expected to be put on a plane home this evening. More than 10,000 parents are being prosecuted every year over child truancy, but truancy rates have still risen. A retired army officer from Hampshire has shot himself after losing his life savings in the hedge funds run by the New York financier Bernard Madoff.
The Prime Minister's appearance before the Commons Liaison Committee this morning was his first since the taxpayer-funded bank bailouts, the VAT cut and the other measures that were introduced last year in a bid to counter the economic downturn. Well, the committee, made of chairmen of the departmental select committees, were also keen to quiz Gordon Brown on his former adviser, Sir James Crosbie, who stepped down as vice chairman of the regulating body, the Financial Services Authority. Our political correspondent, Gillian Hargreaves, watched the session.
It was a mammoth question and answer session, Carolyn. The Prime Minister spoke for over 2 hours, 20 minutes. First of all, he mounted a robust defence of the decision to appoint the former chief executive of HBOS, Sir James Crosbie, to the Financial Services Authority.
The appointment of Sir James to the board was done in a very clear way. A committee was set up to make the appointment. I, of course, as the minister, take responsibility for what happened in that year when the appointment was made, 2003.
Now, a year earlier, that same financial services regulator had investigated the health of HBOS and concluded that the bank needed to strengthen its control infrastructure. In an increasingly grumpy exchange, the Conservative MP Michael Jack asked the Prime Minister if he thought that that first report had been thorough enough.
In 2002, it is absolutely true that the Financial Services Authority conducted a risk assessment into HBOS. They identified a number of issues and then they reached a final assessment on these, that the risk profile of the group had improved and the group had made good progress in addressing the risks.
MPs then moved on to what the government might be able to do to curb the big bonuses that banks are still paying out to some of their employees. And the Prime Minister hinted today that there may be changes in the law.
The short-term bonus culture in banks has got to end. And we're putting in measures that will bring that to an end. The first stage of that is to make sure that performance is based on long-term success, allowing rewards to take place, and not on short-term deals. And the second aspect of that is not to reward failure in any way.
Strong words. Now, we've clarified some of his points with the Treasury today, and we understand that a white paper, government proposals, are being drafted by the Chancellor to change the law on employee remuneration and to give the FSA more power to penalise the banks. They'll be published in time for the budget, which is now set for the 22nd of April.
Thanks very much, Gillian. Well, the Shadow Chancellor, George Osborne, will be gearing up for that, no doubt, Mr. Osborne. But you were listening to the appearance at the liaison committee. Let's just concentrate on Sir James Crosbie and the FSA investigations, if we can, at first. Yeah. Are you willing to accept the Prime Minister's explanation that no information was given to the Treasury about the issues that were raised between the FSA and HBOS? So Mr. Brown himself couldn't have known that Sir James's own bank was being investigated while he was chief executive there.
Well, I accept his explanation in the sense that if it's not true, he's lied to Parliament. And I don't believe the Prime Minister would be so stupid as to do that. But it does beg the extraordinary question, which is how could the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time not know that one of Britain's biggest banks, HBOS, had undergone not one, but in the end, three investigations by the Financial Services Authority. And that during that period, not only was James Crosbie appointed to the board of the FSA, but as late as 2007, he was promoted and made the deputy chairman of the FSA. Now, if it's really the case that the Chancellor of the Exchequer was not told about these investigations going on into HBOS, then it does beg the question, who was in charge of the clattering chain? Who was running Britain's economy and managing its financial system and supervising it whilst the biggest banking crisis of our lifetimes was brewing?
Is that the system that's to blame then? Because the argument would be that this was confidential material, that this was market-sensitive material. That's why it stayed a matter between the FSA and HBOS, no further.
Well, market-sensitive and confidential material is often handled by the Treasury day in, day out, and they should certainly have known if there were problems developing at a bank as systemically important as HBOS. And after all of us as taxpayers have now had to spend many billions of pounds trying to prop up HBOS as part of this new merged bank with Lloyds. And it does point to broader problems with the FSA and its role as a regulator and its relationship with the Treasury. But of course, here too, the trail leads back to Gordon Brown, because he was the man who in 1997 created this system, created the Financial Services Authority, and took away from the Bank of England its traditional role in supervising other banks.
If these problems are, as you say, being highlighted with the FSA, name me one key step that you, the Conservatives, would take to improve the regulatory system?
Well, one key step would be to give the Bank of England much greater power to take a view on overall levels of debt in the economy. No one was looking at the build-up of debt, both at a personal level, but also in people's family finances, but also at the level of banks, and indeed in government debt. There was no overall view on debt. And of course, we now know this was a gigantic boom developing and has led to this very, very severe bust. And
Would you keep the FSA?
Well, it's an interesting question. What our view is at the moment, that you give the Bank of England greater power to call time on levels of debt, to basically exercise macroprudential supervision. But I am very open.
Could you just say that in English?
Yeah. Well, that the Bank of England takes a view on whether banks are capable of being solvent going forward and look at questions like liquidity in the system. And the FSA looks more at things like mis-selling of pensions or mis-selling of products. So you have more of a division of responsibility. So the bank is looking at the overall viability of institutions like HBOS or indeed Royal Bank of Scotland Northern Rock. I mean, just, you know, if I could make this very important point, loss of James Crosbie, you know, is now being followed, we think, today by the loss of Glenn Marino, who has just been appointed by Gordon Brown to head up the institution that's looking after the taxpayer investments in the banks. And I think we've established this afternoon that this man will no longer continue in the foreseeable future as the chairman of UKFI. So to lose two banking advisors in 2 days shows what trouble Gordon Brown is in.
Could you give me a brief answer to this? The new legislation that's being proposed on tackling the bonus culture, does that satisfy you?
Well, I've got to see what it is, but of course we've got to move away from a bonus system that rewards success over a year when a banking cycle can take many, many years,
which is what Gordon Brown is saying he hopes to do.
But I'd make this point: Gordon Brown has been in charge for years and years and years of this system, of the regulatory system that failed. It is no good after the horse has bolted and we've got the biggest banking crisis of our lifetimes, turning up and saying, oh, maybe the system needs to change.
George Osborne, thank you. Now, around 250,000 people around the world visit the Queen's website every week, so the value of the internet won't be lost on her. Now, in fact, she's relaunching her website at a special Buckingham Palace reception in the company of the World Wide Web's inventor, Sir Tim Berners-Lee. Among the new features, a virtual tour of parts of Buckingham Palace. Our Royal Correspondent Peter Hunt was at the reception, so tell us about the site, Peter.
Well, Carolyn, I'm sure as I'm talking to you, you're logged on to the internet to keep across everything that's going on in the world. And I know you're very comfortable in your job. But if you should ever wonder, you know, if the grass was greener anywhere, you can now go to that site and apply for a job online as one of the Queen's employees. Not, I know you wouldn't.
Excellent.
And current vacancies include housekeeping assistant and trainee butler. So that's one of the new innovations. Another, as you were just saying, is these virtual tours. Now, we're all used, aren't we? We go on an estate agent's website, say, looking at a semi in Surbiton. Well, this is a case of royal one-upmanship because the Queen's created virtual rooms from Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle, and so now you can navigate your way around, the palace's grand staircase or the castle's Waterloo Chamber. And she, the Queen, apparently is very impressed with this development because she feels sometimes visitors come, they're overawed, they don't really take it in, now they can go home and take it in. I, of course, should stress that these will all be the public staterooms. There's no chance of a web glimpse of the Queen wandering around her private apartments in her slippers, if indeed a pair, such a pair, has ever graced her feet.
Peter, you are tempting us. Now, what else can people see and do at the site?
Well, this is, as we're suggesting, modern technology. It is also home to archive material.
On my 21st birthday, I welcome the opportunity to speak to all the peoples of the British Commonwealth and Empire.
It includes this, the Queen's celebrated speech in 1947 as Princess Elizabeth. She was visiting the then apartheid South Africa, and the address she made back then amounted to a personal manifesto.
I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong.
Other video footage on the website includes there's some shots of members of the public queuing on the streets in 1923 for a glimpse in a shop window of the late Queen Mother's wedding cake. There's a piece about the apple harvest on the Queen's Sandringham estate. And away from the video, there's also a section on royal pets. And so for the next pub quiz anyone listening is in, they can brush up on their knowledge of Queen Victoria's pugs.
Peter, it's fascinating to hear that, and especially how young she does sound. But why has she done this? Why is she going to the trouble of relaunching the site?
Well, I think you hinted at it right at the start. I mean, she and her advisers just know that a monarchy, and especially an octogenarian monarch, needs to keep relevant. And she's hoping, they're hoping, that this latest version is fresher, more user-friendly. They did, obviously, surveys, as everyone does, beforehand, and people said, for example, that what they most wanted were those 360-degree virtual tours of the palaces, which are now there. And one of the guests at this reception where she launched it was the historian David Starkey, and he was saying that he isn't surprised that the Queen is going down this path.
People have been asking me around the room here, isn't it rather strange, you know, cutting-edge media and sweet Queen in her 80s looking slightly bewildered with it all. Actually, it's not. If we go back to the 16th century, the monarchy is at the cutting edge of a much bigger media revolution than the web. It's called printing.
I should also just tell you quickly that history was made at this reception. My colleague Rory Kefflin-Jones, the BBC's technology correspondent, sent a picture from inside the palace on Twitter. He tweeted it, I think is the correct terminology. It's a royal first, and I have to say it won't become a habit because I can pretty much assure you that the Queen won't be following Rory's example.
Peter Hunt, thank you very much. Now, coming up in the next half hour, how many top civil servants got free tickets to Wimbledon last year? Why the grunt of the Neanderthal may be a myth, and Nils with numbers, and those last two items are not connected. Later this evening, BBC Radio 4 asks whether enough changes have been made to prevent the recurrence of a shocking crime which came to light 10 years ago.
The biggest mass murder this country has ever witnessed, and he wasn't stopped, so something went wrong, catastrophically wrong.
Dr. Harold Shipman murdered hundreds of his patients.
The way in which Shipman could kill, face the relatives, and walk away unsuspected would have been dismissed as fanciful if it had been described in a work of fiction.
A raft of recommendations has been made to prevent future abuses of medical power. But how much has really changed? We ask, could Shipman happen again? Tonight at 8.
You're listening to 2pm. It's 5:30 now. Let's have the BBC News with Carolyn Brown.
A right-wing Dutch politician who's called for the Koran to be banned in the Netherlands will be flown home from Heathrow shortly after being refused entry to Britain. Geert Wilders travelled here to attend a screening of a film that he's made about Islamic extremism, despite being told by the Home Office that he wouldn't be allowed in. Mr. Wilders said Gordon Brown was the biggest coward in Europe. The Muslim peer Lord Ahmed told PM that it was unfortunate Mr. Wilders had attracted so much publicity, but the decision to order him out of the UK was the right one.
At least he's not given the opportunity of inciting people here in London. He can do it from his own country. But, you know, we've had a tradition in the past, those people who have been abusive, insulting, that could lead to a national security threat, we've always banned them.
The Prime Minister has denied that he was warned several years ago about the problems at Halifax Bank of Scotland, which had to be bailed out at huge expense to the taxpayer. Mr. Brown told a committee of MPs that the Financial Services Authority had investigated and warned HBOS about the risks it was taking, but he said the concerns were not passed on to the Treasury while he was the Chancellor. Research by BBC News has found that the number of parents in England and Wales being prosecuted for their child's truancy has almost doubled since 2000. On average, a parent is jailed every 2 weeks, although levels of truancy have not fallen. The Pakistani authorities have acknowledged for the first time that the attacks on the Indian city of Mumbai last November were partly planned in Pakistan. A senior official at the Pakistani Interior Ministry said several suspects had been arrested. Nearly 180 people died in the attacks. A British soldier has died in a shooting incident at his base in the southern Iraqi city of Basra. It's understood that no one else was involved. The soldier's family has been informed. Heavy snow has caused serious disruption across northeast England and the north and east of Scotland. Hundreds of schools have been closed, and police urge drivers in the worst affected areas to travel only if they had to. In the city, the 100 share index closed down 32 points at 4,202.
Thanks, Carolyn. I love the way it sort of jars at the start and takes a little while to get going, but Nils.
I'm glad you still love it, Carolyn.
Okay. For now. You are getting going now with upshares, downshares.
Yes, we keep talking about the possibility of deflation. Bad for car tyres, bad for egos, bad for economies, many would say, because if prices fall consistently, well, so do business incomes, so do wages, and eventually economic growth can be stifled. Well, we haven't got to deflation in Britain yet, but in Ireland they have. The latest consumer price index over there was 0.1% lower than a year ago, the first such fall for almost 50 years. Should Ireland be worried? Should we be worried? Well, a little earlier I talked to Irish economist Russell White at Davies Stockbrokers in Dublin and started by asking why Ireland's price index was falling.
The main reason that we have it so far is that mortgage costs have come down dramatically. Also, energy costs, the decline in oil prices have also fallen significantly. But perhaps later this year, you're going to see more broadly prices falling across the economy. We're not quite at that point yet, but I think that will come in time.
We keep being told that deflation is a bad thing because in the end it can stifle economic growth. Is that how it's perceived in Ireland?
Well, I think there are two distinct types. I think at this point in time, I'm not too sure deflation is that damaging, because what it does, it means your euro, as it is here, goes a lot further. So, you know, your purchasing power goes up. But there is a more damaging type of deflation if people think it's entrenched and it's going to last a long time and the price is going to keep on falling. Well, there's a situation where you mightn't buy today because you think goods will be cheaper tomorrow. And we're not at that point yet. I think that's some way off. But that was the dangerous situation you got into in Japan in the 1990s. So I'm not sure we'll get there, but I suppose that would be the more damaging type of deflation.
Of course, the UK has got some very serious economic problems of its own. Do you think that Ireland's problems are as serious, more serious than the UK?
I don't think there's too much in it. I think Ireland will probably shrink a little bit more significantly than the UK over the next couple of years. If you look at GDP, it will decline more, I would say, in Ireland than in the UK. Perhaps the main difference is that the construction boom would have been bigger in Ireland and growth was much more rapid in the previous 5 or 6 years. So I think Ireland has got further to reverse over the next couple of years. But as you rightly say, the UK has particular problems, particularly related to financial and business services that shouldn't be discounted.
Russell White there. Now, one of the 20 largest companies quoted on the London stock market is the mining group Rio Tinto. It's decided to sell a large chunk of itself to the Chinese state-owned group Chinalco. The plans will raise £13.5 billion and will ultimately give the Chinese group an 18% stake in Rio. The company's chairman, Paul Skinner, has been explaining why he thinks it's a good deal.
We believe that this is a comprehensive solution to all the financing challenges the company faces. We also, at a time when the global economic order is being reshaped, move into partnership mode with a first-class company in our most important partner country.
That's the view from the chairman of Rio Tinto, but some big investment funds with shares in the company are reported to be very unhappy, arguing that if it needs more money, it should have asked all its existing shareholders rather than doing a deal with a Chinese company, which is in fact one of its biggest customers. And separately, the Serious Fraud Office has begun a UK investigation into part of the giant American insurance company AIG, best known over here, of course, as the sponsor of Manchester United. AIG has been rescued by the US government after some of its financial products related to American home loans went quite spectacularly wrong.
And Nils, what about the markets?
Yes, London's 100 share index down 32 points today at 4,202. Over on Wall Street, the Dow Jones index is down 113 points at 7,827. On the foreign exchange markets, the pound is trading tonight at $1.427 and €1.11.3.
Thanks very much. See you tomorrow. The number of parents being prosecuted and even jailed over their child's truancy has increased sharply. A new analysis of court statistics by the BBC has found that in England and Wales, a parent's now jailed on average every fortnight, while prosecutions have almost doubled. But has it made any difference to the number of pupils who skip school? In the first of a new series examining key government policies, James Westhead has gone back to the people we first reported on then to ask, did it work?
The first woman in Britain to be jailed for truancy is facing prison for a second time.
It was a tough new approach to an age-old problem and made headlines.
Teachers claim the jailing of Patricia Amos has helped to cut truancy.
But did jailing the parents of persistent truants actually work? 7 years since Patricia Amos became the first to be jailed, I tracked down her daughter Emma, whose behaviour put her mother in prison and in the news.
Patricia Amos arrived in court under the...
For Emma, watching the old news reports brought back emotions.
What do you make of all this? Last time again?
Definitely weird. Bringing back a lot of memories. It actually makes me want to cry.
Now 21, she has a job in a hotel and ambitions, but admits jailing her mother, though bad at the time, was the shock she needed.
Oh, it worked for me. It absolutely terrified me that my mum was going to prison, and I felt really awful. And when that happened, I just thought, I need to turn my life around, I need to get back into school and prove that I can do this for my mum and for my nan, who had passed away the year before. I think my mum went to prison on the Friday and I went back to school on the Monday and didn't miss another day. I got 100% attendance.
Yeah. Hi. Hello. Hi, young ladies.
How are you?
How are you?
I'm good. It's
you're
a bit cold.
You're looking really well.
Thank you.
We've got a surprise for you today as well.
We took Emma back to her old school for the first time in years to meet her old head teacher and collect her GCSE certificates.
Look, here we are.
Oh my God. The originals.
The originals from 2003.
So I've got the little green slip.
Yeah. So those are the actual certificates.
Can I take them?
Forever. Yeah, of course you can. They're yours.
Thanks. Oh my God.
By contrast, her other sister never returned to school or gained any qualifications, even when their mother was jailed a second time. She now lives on benefits. The head teacher at Banbury School, Fiona Hammonds, admits prosecution doesn't always work.
Certainly for Emma, it worked. She came back to school, she took full advantage of all the support and the learning that was available to her here, left with a crop of GCSEs and has gone from strength to strength. In the situation of her sister, then the educational outcomes have not been the same.
So what's the overall verdict?
The overall verdict that if you can help one child, even from the same family, that's got to be better than not taking that extraordinary sanction and helping no children.
But has the policy succeeded in cutting truancy? The minister in charge at the time was Estelle Morris. She recalls truancy did become something of an obsession for the government.
It was never off the agenda. And although, you know, we'd have a whole host of things going on, it was always one of our accountability mechanisms. So when we went to see the prime ministers, we did on a monthly basis, would be how are the truancy figures. So I suppose you could say it, for the number of children it were, they took up a disproportionate amount of our time.
The original target was to cut truancy by a third. But an analysis by the BBC has found that hasn't worked. Prosecutions in England and Wales have almost doubled, and a parent is now jailed on average once a fortnight. Yet far from bringing down truancy, it's actually increased by a third. Now, former Minister Baroness Morris has doubts about the policy.
I feel uneasy about it, because it's not where I want to be and it's not where I want our education system to be. I think my judgment would be now, if it worked, it was worth it. If it didn't work, it wasn't worth it. Because I never saw it as a punishment. I saw it as a way of bringing about a change in parental behaviour. If I was minister now, I would want to look at the evidence. And if going to prison never works or hardly works, I think I would backtrack.
Hi, I'm from the Truancy Watch Team for the Education Authority. I need to take his details while he's in this girl. OK, can I have his first name, please?
There are still truancy patrols, as well as on-the-spot fines and parenting contracts. But the government no longer talks so tough. It's shifted its focus to easier targets like stopping holidays in term time. Truancy may just be one of those problems which can't be beaten by getting tough.
That was James Westhead reporting. And there is more on the issue of truancy. You can find it on the BBC website. That's bbc.co.uk/did it work. It's got features, on-demand interviews and more facts and figures. And remember as well that if you want to comment on any of the items that you've heard on PM tonight, you can contact us. Go to the glass box, which is on the blog. For the first time, all the corporate hospitality accepted by civil servants is being made public. The recent so-called Lords for Hire allegations has heightened the need for tighter control among those in Whitehall and Westminster, and more lists of corporate hospitality are due to come out later. We've been taking a look through today's list with Ian Dale, the Tory blogger and publisher of the magazine Total Politics. I asked him what some of the civil servants had been offered.
Well, on the face of it, they do. But at least in this country, we can actually see the kind of events that they get invited to and if there's any correlation between the company that invites them to the events and the decisions they make. At least it's all fairly transparent. But you do have to wonder at some of these declarations where you've got Sir Brian Bender, who's Permanent Secretary of the Department of Business and Enterprise and Regulatory Reform. He goes to something once a week. 52 events last year he attended. It makes you wonder whether he's got a bit too much time on his hands and whether he shouldn't have a bit more work to do.
It does seem that some departments are showered with far more gifts than others.
There are others, like the Department for International Development, that apparently only three of their civil servants were invited to anything. It makes you wonder what they've done to be so unpopular. And then Ed Balls's department civil servants, so I think 16. So there are some that are more important to lobbyists than others. And I suppose business and enterprise, it's not surprising in some ways that they do get the most invites.
Some of the invites that we're reading about are for the Chelsea Flower Show, to Wimbledon, concerts, the proms. Not bad postings, really, for a civil servant who's spent a hard day slogging over the computer and the paperwork in the office.
No, but I suspect if we were having this conversation 10 or 20 years ago, we would have been talking about three-day trips to Monte Carlo. I think things have changed and that civil servants are far more aware of how things look to the outside world. And because they have to declare these things now, there are actually fewer of them. So I think those who are insinuating that there's a lot of sleaze involved here actually need to sit back and take a closer look, because I mean, you have to know where to draw the line. Accepting a lunch invitation from someone from a trade body who wants to influence a piece of legislation, I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You can have a meaningful discussion over lunch. Do you need to go to Wimbledon? Do you need to go to the Chelsea Flower Show? I would say probably not. But I don't, if we really think that these people are so easily influenced that if they're invited to something like that, they will then do their master's bidding, I think we ought to really get a grip, because that's not how things work generally.
Do you think that by publishing a list like this for the first time, and there will be further lists, that in some way the question marks over the credibility of Whitehall and Westminster will be restored in any way?
I think it helps, because the public do have a right to know what their public servants are getting up to, whether it's MPs, whether it's peers, whether it's civil servants. They're all working, supposedly, for the public good. And we know we need to know how they're spending their time, who they're being influenced by. And there's been a lot of talk about whether commercial lobbyists are getting too powerful within the political system. And there have been calls for them to be on an official register, so we know exactly who's trying to influence whom. And I think a lot of the rules have been tightened up, but maybe there's a bit further to go. And I think the Freedom of Information Act was a very good thing which this government brought in, and I think all politicians of all parties support it, but it's probably only a stepping stone. I think we need a little bit more transparency, particularly as we've seen in recent weeks, of what our peers get up to.
Ian Dale. Now, just after 6:15, Carolyn has the headlines.
A right-wing Dutch politician who wants his government to ban the Koran has flown out of Heathrow after being refused entry to Britain. Geert Wilders had been told by the Home Office that his views were a threat to public security. Gordon Brown has denied that he was told several years ago of concerns about Halifax Bank of Scotland. Heavy snow has caused disruption in Scotland and northeast England, forcing hundreds of schools to close.
Now, what does Neanderthal man sound like? For many years, we've thought that cavemen made noises a bit like this. That's not an actual recording. But now evidence presented at the American Association for the Advancement of Science conference in Chicago suggests that it doesn't sound like that at all. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh is in Chicago. So what did they sound like then?
Well, there's the intriguing possibility that they might have sounded like you and me. We've just heard here new research presented which suggests that Neanderthals might have been able to speak or had some language. As you've just said, they've had a bad press in the past. They've been portrayed as brutish and primitive. But nevertheless, there's been emerging scientific evidence that they might have been just as clever as us. They've organised themselves socially, they made tools and so forth. And this new research is the latest piece of research along those lines. It was presented by Professor Svante Paabo from the Max Planck Institute, who told us via a teleconference that he'd identified a gene called FOXP2 from the fossilised remains of a Neanderthal in Croatia. And that gene is normally associated with language in modern humans.
We've earlier shown that some Spanish Neanderthals shared those changes with us. We confirm that now in the Croatian Neanderthal that we sequence. So just with respect to this one gene we know that has to do with speech and language, there's no reason to assume they couldn't speak like us.
And what else do you think these genes will be able to tell us about Neanderthal man?
Well, that was the intriguing thing about Professor Paabo's work. He's done the Neanderthal Genome Project. It's like the Human Genome Project, but it's the genes made up from the fossilised remains of these creatures. So we may not need to rely on the fossilised evidence, the detective work that archaeologists have to do to find out what these creatures were like and what they did. We'll have the genes to find out more about what they looked like, how they behaved, the way they organised themselves. So it's very exciting indeed.
And is there still, though, beyond what we're learning today, and my golly, we are learning a lot, aren't we? Is there more to learn about Neanderthal man, do you think?
Well, one of the great mysteries is why a creature that probably was just as clever as us and possibly stronger than us died out, and why we survived. And there's the intriguing possibility that this new evidence might help shed some light on that.
Palab, thank you very, very much indeed. Now, they're vast, lumbering and unique. I'm talking about the giant tortoises of the Galapagos Islands. Charles Darwin was amazed by them, and when he heard that tortoises from different islands had developed different shells, it gave him a vital clue about evolution. Now, on the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth, there's a major campaign to boost their numbers. David Shookman was given special access to this project to save the tortoises.
I'm on the edge of the pen of probably the most famous tortoise in the world. I'm looking at the huge shape of so-called Lonesome George. He's the last of his line of the pinter species of giant tortoise. His huge, steady head is just following the movements of his keeper, Fausto Jennera. He's just lying in the dust. He's chosen on this very sultry afternoon to find shade beneath a low shrub. The park authorities, they've done their best to find him a mate. So far, though, all attempts have failed. So, sad to say, this particular species does face extinction.
All the rest of his species was wiped out, along with three others, for a simple reason. For centuries, the giant tortoises were tempting to passing seafarers. Godfrey Merlin is a veteran conservationist here.
From the very beginning, on the discovery of the Galapagos, the one thing that was noted were the giant tortoises and their abundance. And, of course, they were proven to be very good to eat. Darwin remarks that they were tasty, and many other visitors to the Galapagos remark that they were very good to eat, which was fatal for the giant tortoises of Galapagos.
Those days are long past, and since then a special project has been set up to try to repair the damage to the tortoise populations.
Well, we've been allowed inside the tortoise breeding pen, and I'm treading very warily because all around me are baby tortoises, exactly the same colour as the dark rocks that I'm walking on right now. And I'm told that in this little room at the edge of the pen, we may actually be able to see hatching in progress inside a large household wardrobe, which is where the hatching takes place.
With me is Fausto, the keeper of Lonesome George and of the new generations. No one better understands their ways.
Are there any tortoises that are hatching right now?
In this box there are tortoises and the eggs are hatching.
So these are actually breaking out?
One has just hatched and another is beginning to hatch.
And when did these ones hatch?
They hatched yesterday.
More than 5,000 tortoises have now been released into the wild. This is a conservation success. But there are still threats, such as rats. And Godfrey Merlin says these should be tackled first.
Rats will actually gnaw at the baby tortoises. They will kill them. On the island of Pinson, the tortoise population is being limited by rats. There's no point in just keeping putting tortoises back there where they're going to breed and then the young slaughtered by rats.
A giant tortoise chews the long grass of the highlands, occasionally turning his head towards me. Numbers are now stable, and Emma Ridley, a naturalist and guide, is optimistic.
Well, actually, this is a positive note. In the last 50 years, the situation of the tortoises in Galapagos is far, far better than it was. Many of the islands where the tortoises live, the problem itself has been removed. Goats have been removed, cats, dogs, and in the future, rats as well plan to be removed from these islands.
This one is now sleeping. The heat of the day has passed. These are the strangest creatures on these unique islands, and it will be an effort to safeguard their future.
That was David Shookman reporting from the Galapagos. Loads of reaction from you to the banning of Geert Wilders. This from Tom Winstanley. If he's got issues to raise that need an airing, then banning him will fuel the sense of alienation felt by those in society who feel threatened by the perceived kid glove handling by the government of anything to do with Islam. The government's done neither itself nor society any favours. More in our correspondence roundup tomorrow evening. We first spoke to her as part of PM's Davis Week last December, and somehow we just haven't been able to resist going back for regular updates from yachtswoman Sam Davis, particularly after that dramatic moment when she went to the rescue of a fellow competitor in the Vendée Globe Round the World race. She's now approaching the finishing line in Les Sables d'Olonne in France.
I've got 202 miles to go to the finish line in Les Sables d'Olonne. Normally that shouldn't take very long, but right now there's no wind.
And how many miles have you covered in total?
Oh, in total, I think more than 25,000. I don't actually know. I haven't counted them all up, but it's quite a long way.
But it must be frustrating. These last couple of hundred miles are just that final hurdle that you have to cross.
Yeah, it's very frustrating because I'm going along at snail's pace at the moment. But I think I'm going to be sad when the race is all over. So I'm trying to make the most of these last couple of days on board on my own, peacefully.
Do you think it'll be strange returning to reality?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really weird. I'm really looking forward to getting across the finish line and seeing everybody, especially seeing my team and my friends and family. But I think it's going to be a bit strange to have to adapt back to normal life, having lived in my little boat now for 3 months.
How is Roxy?
She's holding up very well, given all the hard work and strong conditions that we've seen in the last 3 months. And we should make it to the finish in great shape.
Certainly hope so. And what position do you think you hold? I mean, does it matter to you where you come in the race?
It didn't matter to me at all because for me the most important thing was to get round the world, and now I find myself in third place and potentially going for a podium finish. If anyone had told me that I was going to finish in third place before the start, I'd never have believed them.
So what is going to be the very first thing that you will do when you reach land?
The very first thing is hopefully drink a cold beer. although quite quickly after that, I'd like to be able to have a nice hot shower. I've been dreaming about that for days now, months now.
And a sleep in a bed that's not rocking from side to side, or maybe you won't be able to sleep.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a worry. I'm not really sure if I'll be able to sleep in a normal bed and be able to sleep for more than an hour at a time.
And dare I ask if you're already planning another seagoing adventure?
Well, I'm dreaming about doing this race again in 4 years' time and be a favourite to win. Although I'm on the podium at the moment, at the start of the race, I wasn't a favourite to win and not even maybe to get into the top 10. So I'd love to be able to approach the race as a real front runner next time.
Sam Davis, what a girl. Now, let's get the weather forecast with Nina Ridge. Hello, Nina.
Hello, Karen. Thank you. Now, we've been following the snow today. Have to be honest, it was a bit of a surprise to see quite such heavy snow across the United Kingdom. But nonetheless, the Met Office still do have a severe weather warning for heavy snow in force across northeast England, the East Midlands and East Anglia. We're seeing a few flakes of snow across the southeast corner as well, and we might just see a couple of centimetres here over the next few hours as that snow continues to push its way south, clearing away overnight tonight. And then our next problem, of course, as temperatures drop below freezing, is some ice first thing tomorrow morning. I'm going to start the detail tomorrow morning then with Scotland, where the country splits quite nicely into two areas. Western Scotland's going to have a rather cloudy and a damp day, but temperatures of 6 degrees. Meanwhile, central and eastern Scotland will have another cold day, but at least it should be dry and sunny, temperatures at around 2 or 3 degrees with some fairly light winds as well. Now for Northern Ireland, Wales and southwest England. Here it's going to be quite a grey day, a lot of cloud, hill fog, some occasional light rain, but on the plus side, certainly a bit milder than recent days. Temperatures in Plymouth, 9 degrees, 7 in Cardiff and 6 for Belfast. Now on to England, away from that southwest corner. We're looking at a dry day tomorrow. The cloud will come and go, but most places should be dry, bright, and I think during the afternoon we'll see some sunny spells developing. Temperatures still struggling, however, despite that sunshine. London, 5 degrees, 5 in Birmingham and 3 Celsius in Newcastle. Caroline, back to you.
Thanks, Nina. Tomorrow afternoon, BBC Radio 4 continues its tribute to the late Sir John Mortimer with an adventure featuring one of his best-loved characters.
I hadn't been married for a month or so.
Timothy West stars as Horace Rumpel.
I was in the kind of cheerful frame of mind which often prompts me to sing old music hall songs at breakfast.
The veteran barrister returns with a new client, but the same observational wit.
His sense of humour seemed to have come out of some long-defunct boy's comic.
Yeah, just a jolly jape, you see, Mr. Rumpel. And then bish-bash-bosh, we're landed with this writ.
That's Rumpel Returns. The Right to Privacy. The Afternoon Play. Tomorrow at 2:15.
On PM tonight, A Lonely Tortoise and Conversational Caveman. Our editor was Eloise Twisk. She was assisted by Amanda Lewis. We're all back tomorrow night at 5. Have a good evening.
BBC News at 6 o'clock.